We continue now with a look at the Center for Traditional Medicine. Dr. Leslie Korn holds a PhD in behavioral medicine and medical humanities, a master's in cross-cultural health psychology. She's earned a master's in public health from Harvard University. She's the founder and director of the Center for Traditional Medicine. And for those who maybe missed out our earlier segment, can you give us a brief history and mission of the center?
The center was founded in Mexico, and we currently work up here in Olympia. And it's designed to support cultural, traditional health practices that are rooted in nature, that are rooted in nature's approach to healing, and to combine those practices with the best of current knowledge about natural and alternative medicine.
Do you still have a branch in Mexico?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Tell us about how that works. People from here go down there to learn. I mean, go right in the jungle and see how their botanicals work and their methods.
That's correct. We ran a natural medicine public health clinic there for 25 years. And the way that we supported our work was to invite health professionals and students down to live and work in the jungle, to experience culture and life there, to partake of foods, to go traveling into the mountains and jumping into waterfalls and learning hydrotherapy that way. And we had medical residents come down to learn and study, and really to have an organic process in which all types of people from all over the world came together to explore their own cultural heritage in the context of their own healing, and then how they could apply that to helping others heal.
For many years, you were a practitioner there, using touch as one modality to help people deal from the trauma in their lives. And you know, you're working on men, and you relate it in one of your papers linked on the website of the women coming down and making sure that you meant business, that you weren't, you know, there was no hanky panky going on.
That's right.
You want to tell us a bit about that?
Well, certainly, you know, this is a very traditional culture in which men's and women's roles are very strictly defined, and in many ways their lives are quite separate. And absolutely, they needed to make sure that this young woman from the United States wasn't fooling around with their guys.
My mother, growing up in Cuba, the joke was that the only virgin in the United States was the Statue of Liberty. So that gives you a sense of some of the thoughts. Your writings on Mexico are tremendously vivid. I mean, I can see the bright greens and reds when you talk about them. There's a carpenter named Zeke who is one man whose story comes to mind. Can you tell us about working on that? You talked a little bit about him, I think, in the last segment. I think you were talking about a diving accident.
Yes, the men dive there even today with rudimentary or crude diving equipment, and are often along that whole coast very prone to decompression illness, or what's also known as the bends. And so I've had the opportunity to treat a number of the men who've been brought up, who've been very, very ill. And Zeke was one of my first patients there, and really developed a whole technique of massage and nutrition to help get the nitrogen out of his blood. And Zeke, as is everyone there, it's a small village, so we all know everyone. I like to say that we all know when everyone's flushing their toilet. It's that close, and gossip travels fast. And I had the opportunity to work with Zeke over time and to help him walk again. And his whole family became involved in the treatment process. And we always worked there because of it's a village that's rich in resources but poor in money. And so we never accepted money. It was always a gift. And so Zeke helped me rebuild my house when it burned down.
Right. And you tell the story so well. It's linked on the website, centerfortraditionalmedicine.org. Also on the website, a picture of a woman named Doña Clementina Rodriguez Diaz that I'm guessing has been quite a teacher to you.
Yes, she has. I first met Doña Clementina because her husband, Don Juan Cruz, rented my first house to me there. And he was the kind of man, he's since passed on, with whom you did business with a handshake. And I had my home there for 25 years with him just on a handshake. And Doña Clementina would grind coffee that he would bring in from the mountains. And over the years, knew her daughters. They've grown and have treated her and her whole family, and also learned from her a lot of the traditional foods. And recently, we began a series of seminars called Chocolate Chilies and Coconuts, because we found that no matter what seminars we were teaching, people love to be in the kitchen, and that's where they wanted to be. So we turned around everything on its head. We no longer taught medicine and politics and history per se. We taught about food, and through the food, we taught about the medicine, the politics, the history of food. And Doña Clementina is one of our faculty members teaching us the gathering of the foods in the mountains, which are tremendously rich, and teaching us how to use them.
That is a perfect segue into a question I definitely wanted to ask you about. I heard you speak at an introductory session at your Olympia headquarters of the Center for Traditional Medicine, and you mentioned something I found very interesting, how diabetes is a disease of colonialism. And so I'm guessing that's linked to what you were just talking about. Please elaborate on that.
Yes. Diabetes is a modern disease. While it has existed throughout history to a very small extent, we've seen a rapid increase beginning in the 1930s, where it began to rise concomitant to the development of refined foods. However, it was not until about the 1960s that it began to affect Indian tribes. And particularly our focus here is in the Northwest, in Canada and up into Alaska. But we can look into Canada and the East. We can look all over the United States. And what we can do is draw a relationship between the introduction of refined foods, foods that are actually non-nutritious, and the development of diabetes. We're now beginning to see diabetes develop in Asia as the McDonaldization of Asia takes place. And so every place that you see the introduction of sugar, for example, it's fascinating to hear a lot of allopathic practitioners decry the use of fats and meats, and yet fats and meats have sustained the indigenous peoples of the North for centuries with perfect hearts and perfect health and good mental health. It was only with the introduction of the refined foods and the colonization and the role of development in the northern territories that we began to see the decline in health of the Inuit people. And we can see this all over the world taking place. Now, that's not to say it's limited to indigenous people. People in the United States, Euro-Americans, also have indigenous heritage. They often have just forgotten it through the process of migration. But we really encourage people to research their indigenous roots of Europe, even if it goes back several generations, to discover what were the foods that supported their physical, biological, and mental health.
We're talking with Dr. Leslie Korn. She is the director of the Center for Traditional Medicine with branches in Olympia and Mexico. I'm Paul Nelson. So many different threads that we can go from with that. One of them is the notion of food security. This is where we get into the politics that you're talking about, which you relate in the kitchen through eating. So why don't we talk about the link between food security and diabetes?
I'll give you an example, and I will say that I have a number of wonderful colleagues at the center who focus on economic and political analysis, but I'll share with you a little bit of our approach. We look at the traditional foods and what we'd call the authentic foods of a particular environment. If you look at the authentic foods of the Northwest, we have foods that peoples ate here that focused on fish, on wild game, and very low in carbohydrates. Once a year, the carbohydrate roots would emerge and people would eat those carbohydrates. There's access to berries during the summer, but people's traditional foods included also the ulakan, the smelt. Interestingly enough, the ulakan, the term ulakan is the basis for the name of the state Oregon, so that you understand the importance of food in defining culture. And what's happened, though, with the effects of dams, with the role of development and the introduction of pesticides and the degradation of the environment and the lack of support for the ulakan or the smelt runs, is it severely affected and depleted these smelts, which has served as the main foods of peoples all up and down this coast. Now, this is very important because people then no longer have access to these fats that are derived from the smelt, or if they do, it's now selling, the fat of this ulakan sells for up to $200 a gallon. And so you have to then be wealthy to access authentic foods. And the importance of these foods cannot be understated. In fact, the ulakan is so rich in the omega-3s, which is so important for brain function. Some of the work we're doing at the center is looking at how ADD, attention deficit disorder, learning disorders, mental illness, as well as arthritis and diabetes, all arise out of the loss of the access to authentic foods. You can imagine the political and social and economic implications of this in this region alone.
Well, if you looked at an extension of the Bolt decision and suggesting that not only does the United States federal government have a responsibility to allow the native people to have half of the salmon run, but they have to create the conditions in which there is a salmon run, a wild salmon run. And the answer has been salmon farming, which is not the same.
No, it's certainly not the same. Salmon, farmed salmon has virtually none, very few of the nutrients. And we have colleagues who are also working up in the Yakima Nation and addressing the degradation of the environment as a result of Hanford and the effects of nuclear tides in the water and its effect on salmon and the impact on people's lives and the development of cancer in that region, in the Sahaptin region. And so everywhere we look, we see the loss of food security and the development of insecurity.
Yeah. With Americans, the average person goes to the grocery store, sees the chicken and the food and what have you. And so food security, this notion is, I would imagine, alien to the person who is not familiar with a more holistic view or agriculture, you know, sustainable agriculture, that kind of thing. So what I'd like to get a sense of is the average American's food security at risk, would you say?
Of course it is. We've seen this most recently in the awareness of the effects of mad cow. And I would suggest that what we see in the media is just a tip of the iceberg. That generally, by the time we find out about the effects of the loss of food security on our health, the health impact has already taken place. And we can look at dozens of examples. I've given you examples of access to essential fatty acids and the intergenerational effect on stress in ourselves. We know that stress is passed on through the nervous system over time. We know that the loss of good, solid, essential fatty acids and fats gets passed on intergenerationally. And so sometimes we don't see these effects. We see the effects of infertility, and the rise of infertility in young men is being linked to some of the substances that are affecting the fish coming out of the water. So unfortunately, we can see it everywhere. And the mad cow, I think, raised some awareness, but I think there's an effort to suppress that information, and that it's up to individuals and communities to gather together with agricultural initiatives, with community farms, to really follow the adage of buying locally, supporting local farming, not buying processed foods, and really putting on a lot of demand for a change in commercial access.
Mm-hmm. So I'm imagining that a lot of this work that you're discussing comes to the center's Nutrients for Natives program. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yes, I'd be happy to. We developed a program whereby it's very clear, for example, it's not easy to access ulakan oil. And many people with our rushed lives need to take pills and prefer to take pills. And that's why we then take all of our nutrients and our supplements to withstand a lot of the stresses that we encounter. And so we developed the Nutrients for Natives program as a donation program in which people donate funds, and we've also had many nutritional organizations donate nutrients so that we can provide free health care and free nutrients that reduce blood sugar, particularly serving natives with diabetes, though we tend to provide pro bono work to many minorities and poor people. And so we give nutrients that will support antioxidant function, that will decrease the neuropathies associated with diabetes, that decrease stress, that lower blood glucose levels. And we also do consultations and work with tribes to develop capacity within the tribes. This work is not inaccessible. The kind of separation we have as human beings from our ability to heal is really a function of modern life. But all of us can heal. All of us can be healers. All of us are educators. And we need to take back that capacity and that power out of the functions that tend to want to regulate our capacity to do it.
Yeah. For someone who is not an Indigenous person, or should we say someone somewhat disconnected to their own indigenosity, because if you go far back with any of us where there's indigenosity, what methods besides trial and error can we use to have better diets and health? One thing that I've come across in the last few years is the Eat Right for Your Type diet, and it seems to me to have a lot of validity. Those foods that I'm not supposed to eat are listed as toxic, which is not to say that they'll kill me, but a diet of all that probably would.
That's absolutely. I really like Peter Diadamo's work. Indeed, he supported our research in Mexico and provided blood typing test kits for our diabetes research project there. And the blood typing diet is very valid, and it's also part of a larger spectrum that we call metabolic typing, in which you eat according to your cultural heritage. Now, many of us are of mixed heritages, but really paying attention and having awareness of how you feel when you eat certain foods. Many people will eat a food and say, oh, this gives me indigestion, and then take a pill to get rid of the indigestion, rather than saying, what is giving me indigestion and why might that be? And so certainly here in the Northwest, we've got wonderful naturopaths and acupuncturists and natural medicine practitioners, MDs who are practicing natural medicine, who will help you become aware, along with books like Peter Diadamo's, of how to understand that you pay attention to what your body is telling you, not ignore it and try to suppress the symptom with an external medication.
Yeah. In addition, the place in which we live has certain nutrients that if we eat food grown locally, we're likely to be more healthy. Do you find that to be true?
Absolutely. And of course, many of us migrate as well. And so I think really paying attention to what's local and what makes us feel good and how we respond. For example, if you get tired after eating a bagel or eating a sandwich, it may be that it's affecting your blood sugar and you might be better off with what's called a power lunch. Many people in the office will grab their coffee and grab a donut and then have lunch and then feel very tired in the afternoon. That's not a normal experience. It's normal because of what you've eaten. And so thinking in terms of, for example, I'm a big believer in the Atkins diet, high protein and good fats, even though they've been denigrated, really the scientific proof shows that they're very good for your health. And so really understanding who you are metabolically and the right mix of proteins, fats, and carbohydrates in your diet, and whether you feel awake after a meal or feel sleepy after a meal, is just one way to pay attention.
So the Atkins does make sense to you.
Absolutely.
It seems that Dr. Atkins himself wasn't in the greatest health there near the end.
Actually, I understand he was in good health. I think the media has been trying to say that he wasn't, but he was in good health.
Yeah. So when an American person goes down to Mexico, you know, the notion of Mexico, I guess, in mainstream America is one of, you know, let's build a wall and keep all their immigrants out of here. I mean, it's a notion that there is a superiority felt by Americans over Mexicans. Tell us what happens when an American person goes down there with maybe not that kind of hardcore sort of sense of superiority, but maybe somewhere in the unconscious there's that thought. What kind of learning experience happens in that environment?
Well, before I answer that, I'd like to respond because that's a very good point. Let me point out that this continent has been, over the thousands, really, of millennia, people have traveled north and south along the continent for millennia, and it's only really been in the last few hundred years that borders have been created. And so in many ways, as human beings, we retain our animal migratory process. So when people start being upset about Mexicans coming up into what we call the United States, Mexican people of Indian Mexican heritage have always traveled north. Indeed, the Dene have traveled south. And so if we really take a global view of the environment and of the lands, borders are really an artificial creation that's very recent in time that I don't think will really stem any kind of migration process. That said, I think you're absolutely right that people in the United States have a kind of chauvinism. Indeed, my favorite students really come from Europe because they have had such a wonderful education and ability to be exposed to vast cultures and vast types of ways of living, in contrast to many of our American students have been very insulated in their exposure. And so one of the things that we enjoy doing is receiving American students in Mexico so that we can blow wide open this National Geographic idea of indigenous people sitting in a cave smoking something to alter their consciousness, to really understand that indigeneity takes many forms and that indeed people living in an authentic lifestyle have far more to teach than people who live on a street corner that don't know the person next door to them.
Unless those indigenous people want to learn about Friends or what the Yankees are doing or whatever is emerging in pop culture. You know, the message we get from the mainstream media is quite different than the one you're giving us today. What do you say to people listening who resonate with your message but see something different reflected in the media and the culture in general?
Well, I think we dig deeper into the media. I think there's a lot of good media out there. I think it's just not very accessible. I'm a real believer in what Charles Tart, the experimental psychologist, calls the consensus trance. The idea that we all agree on the nature of reality and then go about assuming that that is reality, when in fact we're just walking, sleeping people.
As my indigenous friend would say, if we are walking, sleeping people, we're in for a big surprise, aren't we?
That's right. And so all of our work is about waking up.
And the center is a prime force in doing that in the Northwest. And if people are in need of healing or in need of research or in need of education, we can refer them to your website. That might be the best way, or a phone number. A phone number would be good, too.
Our phone is 360-236-8750 or 754-1990.
And we'll have links on our website. Of course, you'll find their website at centerfortraditionalmedicine.org. Dr. Korn, thanks for being on the show. Continued success with your work.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Leslie Korn, the director of the Center for Traditional Medicine.